Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling something huge, how life, specifically plants and fungi, actually conquered dry land. It's a massive evolutionary story.
It really is.
And we're diving into it using insights from a fascinating lecture by Dr. Ty C.M. Hoffman.
Yeah, Dr. Hoffman lays it out really clearly.
Our goal here is to unpack how these two, kingdoms managed it. What were the key changes, the innovations in structure, the phylogenetic twists that let them move from water to a pretty harsh land environment?
And right off the bat, Dr. Hoffman tackles a big misconception. You see plants and fungi growing side by side, maybe in your garden or the woods, and you think, okay, they must be related somehow.
They look the part, don't they? Stationary, rooted in the ground.
Exactly. But phylogenetically, nope. Dr. Hoffman points out fungi are actually closer relatives to us, to animals, than they are to plants. It's kind of mind-bending when you first hear it.
Okay, closer to animals. How? Mm-hmm. What's the fundamental difference that splits them off from plants so dramatically?
It boils down to the most basic thing, how they get food. Nutrition.
Mm.
Plants are the great producers, right?
Yeah.
Photoautotrophs. They make their own food using sunlight.
Right, photosynthesis.
But fungi, they're like animals in that they're heterotrophs. They can't make their own food. They have to get their organic compounds from, well, from somewhere else. They consume.
Okay, so they're consumers like us. Let's dig into that connection a bit. Because Dr. Hoffman draws this really interesting parallel in how digestion actually works.
It's fascinating, actually. Think about animal digestion, our digestion. We take food in. Into our alimentary canal, basically, a tube running through us from mouth to anus.
Okay.
And Dr. Hoffman makes this great point. Technically, the space inside that tube is outside our body cells. It's like the hole in a bagel. It runs through the bagel, but it's not part of the bagel dough itself.
Huh. Never thought of it that way. So digestion happens in this external tunnel we carry around?
Pretty much. We secrete digestive enzymes into that tunnel, break down the food, and then absorb the small molecules into our actual body cells. The key is we're animated. We move, we carry that digestive process to the food source.
Right, we go find a burger.
Exactly. Now, fungi, they do the exact same chemistry. They secrete enzymes onto their food source to break it down externally. But they don't move to the food.
They live right on it.
They live right on it. They just wait for those enzymes to do the work, breaking down, say, a log or leaf litter. And then they absorb the resulting small molecules, amino acids, sugars, whatever, directly through their cell walls.
So same chemical process, just outside in versus inside out, almost. One moves, one stays put.
Precisely. It's about lifestyle. Animals move, fungi maximize surface area where they are.
Which leads to their structure, which we'll get to. But first, let's flip back to the plants. If fungi are pseudo-animals in a way, who are plants' closest relatives back in the water.
Well, Dr. Hoffman clarifies this using molecular data. You might look at green algae and think, okay, maybe those chlorophyta are the ancestors. They look pretty similar.
Yeah, it makes visual sense.
But the DNA tells a different story. Plants' closest relatives are actually another group of green algae called the Charophyta.
Okay, so what's the molecular smoking gun there? What links them so tightly?
It comes down to how they build their cell walls. Both plants and Charophyta use cellulose, which is common, sure. But Dr. Hoffman highlights something unique they both share.
Which is?
They have these specific circular arrangements of proteins in their cell membranes. Think of them as tiny molecular machines, little rosettes, that synthesize and spin out the cellulose fibers.
Ah, so it's not just that they use cellulose, but the specific factory machinery they use to make it.
Exactly. Other organisms that use cellulose don't have this particular ring-like structure. It's a very strong piece of evidence linking just plants and Charophyta.
Got it. And the reason we're even talking about plants and fungi together today, despite being so far apart on the evolutionary tree,
is because, as Dr. Hoffman emphasizes, they seem to have arrived on land around the same time, about 475 million years ago. They didn't just arrive together. They fundamentally shaped each other's evolution. They co-evolved.
Right. You can't really tell the story of one without the other.
Definitely not. And to understand how plants specifically made that leap, we need to get into their really unique way of handling reproduction and chromosomes, ploidy.
Ploidy, the number of sets of chromosomes. N for one set, haploid. 2N for two sets, diploid.
And any organism doing sexual reproduction has to juggle this, right? Fertilization takes two haploid N gametes, fuses them into a diploid 2N zygote.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere else in the life cycle, you need meiosis to cut that number back down from 2N to N. Otherwise, chromosomes just keep doubling every generation.
So how do plants solve this? Because it's different from us and from fungi.
Very different. It's called alternation of generations. Let's contrast. Animals, like us, are multicellular only in the diploid stage. Our body is 2N. The only haploid entities we have is our gametes, sperm, and eggs, and they're single-celled. Fungi, interestingly, are kind of the opposite. They spend most of their multicellular life in the haploid N stage. The diploid 2N stage is often just a very brief, single-celled zygote that immediately undergoes meiosis to get back to being haploid.
So animals are multicellular diploid, fungi are mostly multicellular haploid. What about plants?
Plants are the odd ones out. They went for both. They have a fully multicellular haploid stage and a fully multicellular diploid stage in their life cycle.
Whoa, two distinct bodies.
Yep. There's the gametophyte, which is the multicellular haploid N plant body. Its job is to produce the gametes, sperm, and eggs. Then, after fertilization, the resulting diploid zygote grows into the sporophyte, which is the multicellular diploid 2N plant body. Its job is to produce spores through meiosis.
So the gamete-producing plant and the spore-producing plant, two generations alternating, that's complex.
It is, but it was clearly a successful strategy for tackling land. And building on that unique life cycle, Dr. Hoffman outlines four major milestones, four key innovations that mark the evolution of the major plant groups we see today.
Okay, let's walk through them. Milestone number one.
The earliest successful land plants we know of are the bryophytes. Think mosses, liverworts, hornworts.
Yeah.
They're considered the most ancestral or primitive land group that really made it.
They have a major limitation, right?
A huge one. They are non-vascular. They lack specialized tissues, xylem, and phloem for transporting water and nutrients long distances.
No internal plumbing. And that's critical because diffusion, just letting stuff soak from cell to cell, is incredibly slow over any real distance. Dr. Hoffman had that calculation. Like, diffusion from your foot to your head could take decades.
Yeah, something crazy like that.
Uh-huh.
So without vessels, bryophytes are stuck being small and low to the ground where they can absorb water directly.
And in their life cycle, that haploid gamete phyte generation is the main event.
Correct. In bryophytes, the green leafy part you typically see is the haploid gametophyte. The diploid sporophyte is often smaller, sometimes even nutritionally dependent on the gametophyte growing out of it.
Okay, so a small size, dominant gamephyte. That sets the stage for the next big leap, driven by the need to get bigger, right? Milestone two.
Exactly. Around 425 million years ago, we see the evolution of vascular plants. This is where xylem and phloem, that internal plumbing, appears.
Game changer.
Total game changer. Suddenly, plants could efficiently move water up from the soil and sugars down from the leaves. This allowed them to grow tall, develop proper roots and leaves, and compete much more effectively for sunlight. Size became possible.
Getting bigger, getting off the ground. Okay, milestone three. What came after vascular tissue?
About 300 million years ago, seeded plants evolved. This was another massive innovation, this time focused on reproduction and dispersal in a dry environment.
The seed. We all know seeds, but what makes them so special evolutionarily?
Dr. Hoffman describes the seed as this incredible survival package. Inside, you have a multicellular embryo, which is actually the next tiny sporophyte generation already developed.
Okay.
That embryo is protected by a tough, desiccation-resistant coat. And crucially, it comes packed with its own food supply.
The packed lunch we talked about earlier.
Exactly. So this whole package can survive harsh conditions like drought or cold, sometimes for years, even centuries. It can wait, essentially dormant with almost no metabolism, until the conditions are just right for germination. Maybe it needs fire, maybe heavy rain.
It allows plants to really spread out and colonize new, challenging places.
Hugely. It decouples reproduction from the immediate need for water, which is a major constraint for earlier plants that relied on swimming sperm.
Right. And that brings us to the fourth and maybe most familiar group.
The angiosperms. The flowering plants. These are the dominant plants today. Most trees, shrubs, grasses, flowers you see are angiosperms. Dr. Hoffman flags them with the three Fs.
Flowers, fruit, and double fertilization.
Double fertilization, yeah. Yes. Flowers are obviously for attracting pollinators. Fruit develops from the flower's ovary, protecting the seeds and aiding dispersal, often by animals. But double fertilization is a really unique and efficient reproductive mechanism specific to angiosperms.
How does that work? It sounds complicated.
It is a bit, but super clever. When the pollen grain lands and delivers its genetic material, it actually delivers two sperm nuclei to the female ovule.
Two? Why two?
Well, one sperm nucleus does the expected thing. It fuses with the egg cell to form the diploid 2N zygote, which will grow into the embryo. Standard fertilization.
Okay, makes sense. What about the second one?
The second sperm nucleus fuses with two other nuclei, already present in the female structure. So you get a fusion of three nuclei.
Creating a triploid 3N cell.
Exactly. And that triploid cell divides and develops into the endosperm.
Which is the food supply in the seed, right? Like right. In corn or wheat.
Precisely. So the genius here is that the angiosperm only invests energy in creating the food supply, the endosperm, at the same time that fertilization of the egg actually occurs. There's no wasted effort making food for an ovule that doesn't get fertilized.
Ah, very efficient. Link the baby and the packed lunch formation directly.
It's a key reason for their incredible success.
Okay, so that's the plant trajectory. Let's swing back to the fungi, who've been evolving alongside all this. What about their structure? We said they stay put and digest externally.
Right. So excluding the single-celled yeasts, most fungi are multicellular. Their main body is called the mycelium.
Which you usually don't see, right? It's underground or inside the wood or whatever.
Exactly. The mycelium is this vast, sprawling network of incredibly fine, thread-like filaments called hyphae. They branch out extensively through their food source.
And that structure is key to their lifestyle.
Absolutely. Think about surface area. Like the lining of our small intestine is highly folded to maximize absorption. The mycelium's network of thin, branched hyphae creates an enormous surface area for secreting enzymes and absorbing the digested nutrients. It's perfectly adapted for that external digestion strategy.
So these hidden networks are just everywhere, silently doing their work. And this structure, this lifestyle, sets them up for really important interactions with plants. Symbiosis.
Yes. Dr. Hoffman covered three really critical examples of plant-fungus symbiosis. The first one is absolutely fundamental. Mycorrhizae. Literally means fungus roots.
Okay, what's happening there?
It's a mutualism. The fungal hyphae associate intimately with the plant's roots. Sometimes they form a sheath around the root. Other times, the hyphae actually penetrate into the root cells. Dr. Hoffman used the analogy of pushing your fingers into a water balloon without breaking the balloon.
Creating massive contact area inside the root itself.
Exactly. And the fungus is much better than the plant root alone at exploring the soil and absorbing certain nutrients, especially phosphorus and water. It acts like an extension of the root system.
So the fungus provides nutrients to the plant. What does the plant get back?
Sugars. The product's photosynthesis. The fungus can't make its own food, remember? So the plant feeds it sugars in exchange for water and minerals. It's a crucial partnership. Many plants struggle or can't survive without their mycorrhizal fungi, especially early land plants trying to colonize nutrient-poor soils.
Wow. Okay, symbiosis number two.
Lichens. Which are weird because a lichen isn't actually a single organism at all.
Right, it's a partnership.
It's a composite organism, a symbiosis between a fungus and a photosynthetic partner, which is usually a green alga or sometimes a cyanobacterium.
And what's their big ecological role? They grow on bare rock.
They do. Mm. And that's their key contribution, especially early on. Lichens are pioneer organisms. They can colonize bare rock. And through physical and chemical action, they start to break that rock down. This is one of the fundamental processes that create soil.
They're literally making the ground fertile for other plants to eventually move in.
Paving the way. Without lichens, soil formation would be vastly slower.
Incredible. And the third symbiotic relationship.
Endophytes. These are fungi that live inside plant tissues, leaves, stems often without causing any disease. Endo meaning within, fight meaning plant.
And they're beneficial. How?
Often, yes. Dr. Hoffman mentioned studies showing that many endophytes produce chemical compounds that protect the host plant. These compounds might deter herbivores from eating the leaves, or they might fight off bacterial or other fungal pathogens.
So the fungus gets a safe place to live inside the plant.
And the plant gets, effectively, a kind of bodyguard or immune boost.
Yeah.
Another win-win.
These relationships just underscore how intertwined these two kingdoms are. Which brings us back to coevolution, especially with those super successful angiosperms. Dr. Hoffman used flower symmetry as a great example.
Yeah, this was a neat study he cited. It looks at the difference between flowers with radial symmetry, like a daisy, where you can cut it multiple ways and get mirror images in flowers with bilateral symmetry, like a snapdragon or an orchid, where there's only one line of symmetry, like a human face.
Okay, radial versus bilateral. How does that connect to evolution?
It's about controlling the pollinator. A radially symmetric flower is pretty open. A bee can approach it from many angles to get nectar. But a bilaterally symmetric flower often has a much more specific structure. It forces the pollinator, say a bee of a certain size, to enter in a very particular way to reach the nectar.
Like a specialized landing pad or tunnel?
Exactly. And because the entry is so restricted, the flower can ensure that pollen gets placed on a very specific part of the bee's body, and that pollen from another flower gets deposited precisely on the stigma. It's much more targeted.
Okay, more targeted pollination. What's the evolutionary consequence of that?
The study Dr. Hoffman mentioned showed that this restriction leads to less mixing, less gene flow between different populations of these plants. The specialized relationship with the pollinator effectively isolates them reproductively.
And reproductive isolation is the key to
speciation, the formation of new species. By having these restrictive, bilaterally symmetric flowers, these plant lineages tend to diversify much more rapidly. They undergo more adaptive radiation. The evolution of the flower shape is directly driving the evolution of new plant species, all mediated by the interaction with the animal pollinator.
Wow. So the shape of the flower, driven by the bee, speeds up the plant's own evolution. That's co-evolution in action.
Absolutely. It perfectly illustrates how plants, fungi, and animals have all shaped each other's journeys on land.
So wrapping this up, it's clear that plants and fungi didn't just, you know, wash ashore and hope for the best. They actively engineered the conquest of land through incredible innovations, vascular tissue, seeds, that unique alternation of generations, complex chemical defenses, and these deep, essential symbiotic partnerships.
They built the terrestrial world as we know it, step by step, often relying on each other.
And Dr. Hoffman left off with a pretty powerful thought, linking this immense history to our present moment.
Yes. He emphasized that plants are still the primary producers on land. Everything ultimately depends on them. And when you consider this vast timescale, 475 million years of evolution we've just discussed, and then you look at the kind of images he showed, the current rates of deforestation, of clear cutting, removing the foundation of entire ecosystems in just a few decades.
It forces you to ask a hard question.
It really does. What are the true long-term consequences for the stability of the entire global ecosystem? An ecosystem built on these co-evolved relationships over hundreds of millions of years when we dismantle that foundation so rapidly. That's the crucial takeaway, the question we really need to grapple with.